What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Today I'm chatting to Alam Shaha, science communicator, teacher and author. Alam has spent much of his professional life sharing his passion for science and education with the public, taking a creative approach that's been recognised with fellowships from the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts and the Nuffield Foundation. In 2012, he published the Young Atheist Handbook, Living a Good Life Without God, which detailed his journey from Islam to humanism. Alam's other titles include Mr. Shaha's Recipes for Wonder and Mr. Shaha's Marvelous Machines. His latest book, written for adults, Why Don't Things Fall Up, was published this year. Alam Shaha, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we first met when you'd written a book called The Young Atheist Handbook, or maybe you were just about to have it published. Anyway, you'd written it. It was ready to go. And the premise of that book was all about your leaving of a religion, your leaving of Islam in which you'd grown up. Why do you think it was that you grew away from that religion?
I think there are two parts to that answer. One was that I always struggled to believe any of its tenets, really. I don't think I really believed in a God from a very young age. Quite simply, the idea of a God, the kind that was presented to me, a kind of anthropomorphic God, literally a kind of big scary man who would punish me if I did bad things, I just didn't buy it.
You never did?
I don't think not so. Really. I think maybe when I was a very young child, but you know, I can remember being in primary school and not feeling that the idea was true. And then secondly, my mother died when I was 13, which for me had lots of negative consequences. But one kind of positive consequence was that I really didn't feel any pressure to believe or go along with what the people around me believed and said I should believe. So it was a point at which my relationships with my father, which were never very good, and with the community around me were severed in a sense. So unlike a lot of people from Muslim backgrounds, what I didn't have was a familial pressure to conform, to pretend to believe.
And it sounds like you didn't feel any sense of obligation.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I think if my mother had been around, things might have been different, because you know, my mother was the person I loved most in the world. I cared deeply about her and what she thought of me. And I think had she not died, that may have influenced how I developed my relationship with Islam.
You remember her, obviously. Was she seriously religious, or was she just religious in the normal way that someone is if it's their, you know, family background and their culture?
I feel it's almost improper for me to speak for her because, you know, I didn't know her as an adult and I never got the opportunity to discuss these matters with her. But I am fairly certain that her faith or her understanding of it was a source of comfort to her. And my suspicion is, having discussed this with lots of fellow ex-Muslims, is that she grew up at a time and in a community where the idea of not believing, the idea of rejecting Islam, was anathema, you know. And what I've seen recently, it just even recently with someone I know who's going through this, is that mothers tend to be people who we find very difficult to upset, you know. And one of the common themes amongst ex-Muslim narratives is, you know, the desire not to hurt a parent who we love deeply. And as I said, that was something that was taken away from me. I didn't have to deal with that, and it made it much easier to be honest with myself and with the world at large.
Just tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, what that community in that time was that you're referring to. So it start maybe with your mother's background.
So I arrived in Bangladesh in about 1977 with my mother. I was just about to turn 3. She had lived in Bangladesh in a farming village, essentially, with me, while my father had already arrived in England at a time where some of your readers may not believe, but Great Britain was encouraging immigration here. And
what is this crazy world?
Yeah, I mean, they were giving people like my father free plane tickets to come here because there was a shortage of workers in things like bus drivers and factory workers and so forth. You know, my father's first job was in the Dagenham Ford plant, I think. Yeah. You know, there was a shortage of labour, and so there was a wave of immigration from places like Bangladesh, and the menfolk often came over first and saved up some money and so forth. So my mum arrived here with her firstborn. Well, oddly enough, I was her secondborn child. Her firstborn child had died. So she came here with me, not speaking English. And we were placed in housing on a council estate in the Elephant and Castle eventually, where lots of other Bangladeshi families and, in fact, Irish families were housed. And the setup of the place, the kind of physical structure of the housing estate, was such that, you know, there was a real sense of community. We used to walk in and out of each other's houses. And it was a very different time, you know. I remember having my own door key at about the age of 5. Mm. And it wouldn't be unusual to just go and knock on your mate's door and ask them to play out at any time of the day. So in that sense, it was a wonderful sense of community. And I think one of the thoughts I have about community is that community is funny because it can be a source of tremendous support and friendship and love and all these things that we humanists look for in our fellow humans. However, I think community often comes with an obligation to conform, with an obligation to believe the same things, hold the same values. And that's when community can become problematic. And I think that's true of all communities, not just the one I happen to grow up in.
But you didn't feel, with your mother not present, you didn't feel that obligation to the remainder of your community, to your father and to those others around you, in the same way, as you say.
I had a very peculiar relationship with that community where, I'm sure your listeners won't believe this, but as a child, I was quite wild and a bit out of control, I suppose. And part of the reason for that was my mother was unwell a lot of the time. She had mental health issues and so forth. And my father was absent in other ways. And so I had a peculiarly free childhood in the sense that I was often left to my own devices. And a thing I remember which still makes me laugh was a lot of my best friends, the children I used to run around with, were told not to play with me until at the age of 11, I passed the 11 plus exam and got an assisted place to the local private school, at which point the parents were all like, oh, you should definitely play with Alon.
You know, see Alon.
But I think, you know, because of my particular family circumstances and who I was as a child, I didn't always feel welcomed by the community. I felt rejected in some ways already.
Right.
And there were things like, for example, my father, and this is quite personal, but I'm happy to share it because my father's dead now. You know, he had a horrible gambling habit, which impacted very negatively on our family. But it was a kind of community where, you know, even adults would say negative things to me about him to my face. And so, you know, there were lots of things growing up that made me feel that this community wasn't particularly supportive of me as a child. And then I felt that particularly keenly when my mother died. I felt that there were no adults who were actually taking any responsibility for me and my siblings. I felt very much alone at that time. And, you know, that I think that all contributed towards my ultimate feeling that, you know, I didn't owe this community anything.
Right. So you never really believed anyway, and there was no, or probably not, and there was no real sense of obligation or belonging to hold you in. But still, it's, you must have thought something in addition to all of that in order to want to make the step of publishing these thoughts and ideas, you know, sort of coming out, as it were, not just to those around you, but in words, in print. What was your motivation?
It's funny because I didn't see the book as coming out. I felt that, you know, to my immediate friends and family, I kind of was out. You know, all my close Bangladeshi friends knew my views about these things. And as I said, I was very lucky compared to a lot of ex-Muslims in that I didn't have any adults or grown-ups who could get angry at me or threaten me with anything. So, you know, I didn't feel that I was coming out to anybody. What motivated the Young Atheist Handbook was my experience as a teacher, really, and encountering young people who I felt wanted to know more about atheism in my discussions as a physics teacher, believe it or not, you know, talking about the Big Bang theory or teaching evolution by natural selection as a science teacher, not just a physics teacher. You know, there were conversations I was having in class which I couldn't have completely, you know, which would have been inappropriate to follow through in a classroom setting as a teacher. But I felt strongly that a lot of young people that I was teaching wanted to understand atheism better. And I guess having written, you know, documentaries for television and so forth, I thought maybe I could write a book that was accessible to young people that, you know, talked about the kind of things atheists believe in a way that was accessible to young people. And the first draft of the book was very, very straightforward. It was much more a straightforward non-fiction tome and with nothing personal about my background and so forth. And when I took this book proposal to the woman who became my agent, she said, this is a very good idea, but nobody's going to buy this book. And I thought, oh, well, OK, that's the end of the meeting then. But and then she said something which changed my life. Literally, she said, but you can write. Why don't you write about why you're an atheist, why you don't believe in God and so forth? And I went away and did exactly that. And it was a, you know, it wasn't my original plan. But just having the suggestion put to me kind of inspired me to go away and tell my story. And it was quite cathartic, if I'm honest. Mm. You know, it was not something I had intended, but once I started writing it, the book really did, it's a cliche, but it did very much write itself. And, you know, in a way, I'm very happy to have written that book because I'm very proud of it. But at the same time, there's part of me that cringes at the stuff that I shared in it and at the thought that my daughters will read it. But you know, the original motivation for the book was my conversations with young people as a school teacher.
So it was as an educator, really, that you were motivated.
Yeah, I mean, I've done lots of things for work in my life since I was 16. You know, ranging from waiting on tables to working as a constituency caseworker for a member of parliament. to working in television and so forth. But ultimately, I think, you know, the role that has been most fulfilling to me, and the role for which I think if I have a natural aptitude for anything, it's being a teacher. And, you know, teaching is a job for which I have a bit of a love-hate relationship. I think there are lots of good things about it, but the kind of practicalities of it can be very challenging. But one of the things that I enjoy about teaching is having conversations with bright young people who I think still have that sense that they are invincible and that the world is there for them to do what they please. And as I said, more than 10 years ago now, it was once I returned to teaching after working in television for 10 years, and which really shifted my perspective on what I could do as an educator. You know, I was having these conversations on many occasions, and I thought, yeah, you know, maybe I could write something for young people that would help them understand an atheist viewpoint. But then, because of my agent, it ended up being this weird combination of memoir and a straightforward kind of exposition of atheistic ideas.
Where do you think this passion for education comes from, or for teaching? I mean, you said, you know, the joy of engaging with these bright young people who feel that they're... Did you once feel like that? I mean, like a lot of us, a lot of assisted place children, of course, and we've had this conversation before, because I'm one too. And when you talk to people who had assisted places, it's a bit like talking to people who went to grammar school sort of 70 years before. They've got this moment in their lives when there was like an incredible revelation of knowledge and of insights, and they met a lot of good teachers. I mean, was that the moment when education became the important thing for you, or teachers became the important thing for you, or was it something else?
I think I was very lucky that I had teachers at primary school who were the kind of teacher that I aspire to be, and teachers who really cared about their students, who would go out of their way to ensure their students could flourish. And I didn't appreciate it necessarily at the time. And, you know, all the way through primary school and secondary school, I never thought I'd want to grow up to be a teacher. However, I think those teachers had a profound influence on me and, in fact, shaped my humanistic worldview. I think, you know, as an atheist, and a humanist, I need to make my own meaning and purpose in this life. And for me, one way of doing that is to simply be useful to other people, you know. And there are jobs like being a doctor and so forth. But for me, being a teacher was an easy way to do that, to accomplish that. And I kind of stumbled into it by accident. And once I became a teacher and I realized that it provided a sense of fulfillment unlike anything else. And that was really hammered home to me when I left teaching and went to work in television, which for some people is a far more impressive career. It certainly impressed people far more than teaching used to when I told them what I did at parties and so forth. But, you know, one of the reasons why I left television and went back into teaching was that television didn't provide me with the same sense of fulfillment and purpose that teaching did. And one of the things that I also missed about teaching was the sense of being part of a community with a common purpose. And I think that's what schools are. I think one of the things that really upsets me is the kind of move to run schools as if they're businesses and, you know, or banks or something. Whereas, you know, schools are communities. They're much more like a village than a bank. And what's wonderful about a good school when it works is that the shared purpose that we have is to ensure the flourishing of all the children at that school. And in fact, a particularly fantastic school, what it should do, in my opinion, is ensure the flourishing not just of the students, but also of the teachers. And, you know, there are very few communities out there like that. You know, this is quite different to a religious community, in my view, in that religious communities want you to believe certain things and flourish in the afterlife. But, you know, a school community, that's about preparing people for this life and ensuring that they can get the most out of this life. And that all may sound rather grandiose, but, you know, that's what we do. That's what was done to me. You know, was very, very, I feel very, very fortunate to have had the education that I have had. And, you know, I feel, you know, that's silly. I don't know what my life would have been like had I not had the teachers and the education that I did. But, you know, I touched briefly on the fact that I was a bit out of control as a child. And I think, you know, if I hadn't gone to the particular secondary school that I had gone to, I think, you know, any intellect or talents that I had may have been put to less good use, shall we say.
I think you can say that you know that. I mean, I certainly know that about myself. You know, the Sutton Trust did a retrospective report on the assisted play scheme from 1979 to when it ended. And they compared the children who'd gone through the assisted play scheme to their home cohort, as it were, from the communities they'd come from. And, you know, I'm here to tell you that if you were, even if one was the most brilliant person in the world, full of exceptional talent, you know, that their study found that it was your schooling that really dictated your future. And the assisted place children succeeded against the measures of success that we're sort of talking about here. And unfortunately, their peers who didn't have the same opportunities just didn't.
That's very interesting, because I think it also touches on why I'm an educator and the kind of sense of guilt that I feel.
Do you? Do you feel guilty having opportunities? I suppose, you feel guilty for having had those opportunities?
I do. I think I spoke to a psychiatrist friend of mine once, or maybe psychologist. I can never remember the difference. And they said that I had a survivor's guilt.
Wow.
You know, and I think, I don't know if that's true or not, but I certainly feel very, very lucky. I feel that I was given opportunities and privileges by accident, really, that I happened to pass this exam when I was 11. Mm. And, you know, I didn't even plan to take it, Andrew. Basically, I had applied to go to the local boys' school, which was where all the kind of hard kids went, if you like. And I wanted to go to the school with all the hard kids. And my head teacher, he called me into his office and he said, you know, I see you've put down Scott Lidgett. That was the name of the school. I see you've put down Scott Lidgett as your first choice. And I said, yes, sir, that's where I want to go. And he said, well, there's another school that I think you might like better, but you'd have to take a test. And I adored my head teacher. You know, I absolutely respected him. And I just said, yes, sir, whatever. I remember going for an interview, which was a really awkward, weird experience, dressed in a safari suit, which is in my Bangladeshi community, that was considered the height of smart dress, and with my hair plastered down with Brill cream, you know. And you know, the head teacher at Alain's asking me about cricket, in which I had no interest. Yeah. He asked me all sorts of other questions. And I, because I wasn't nervous, because I didn't really know it was a big deal, I think I was just relaxed and sufficiently coherent that I somehow passed the interview. And then I also somehow passed the written exam. Mm. And, you know, it was a life-changing moment for me. But, you know, to me, it's deeply, deeply unfair that I was given that chance.
Is this an abstract thing for you, or do you know other people, as it were, from your...
I know none of my other friends got to go to private school when I was 11. You know, none of the other students in my year group went to Alain's or Dulwich College or any of the fancy schools. No. You know, and none of the other students were... none of my friends were approached to enter the exam. Mm. So, you know, I think that's unfair. And, you know, I benefited hugely from the kind of education that was on offer at Alain's. And it certainly led me on a quite different path to what my peers had. And I suspect there's part of me that does feel guilty.
Is your teaching, is your motivation for teaching in part working through your guilt, do you think?
I don't know. I think, you know, I've spoken about why I teach elsewhere. And I think teaching for me, as I said, is one way to serve. But at the same time, you know, I get an awful lot out of teaching. So, you know, I'm very lucky now. I'm about to have my fourth book published and a fifth one next year. And all of my books have been inspired by the children I work with and about what I think about education. And, you know, I don't think I'd be a writer of any sort today if it wasn't for the fact that I'm teaching young people and constantly thinking about their needs and wants and so forth. You know, I get a lot out of teaching and not just a wage.
You're not just a teacher, of course, you're specifically obviously a science teacher. So should we talk a little bit about science? Because
absolutely.
I never talked about science before. That's odd. Maybe it's because I'm not particularly interested in science, as you know.
In which case, you're going to love my new book, which is, if I may plug it, it's written specifically for people who either didn't like science at school or weren't paying attention, but now as adults have an inkling that they probably ought to have learnt something or understand it at least.
Oh, no, I don't feel like that, Alan. No.
You don't. I'm going to make you read my book anyway.
I'm going to read it. Of course I'll read it. Straight away, you were grabbed by science? Always been your passion? No? Okay.
No, not at all. No, I found it quite boring and didn't particularly get on with my science teachers in early secondary school. I recount my story in the Young Atheist Handbook where I had this particularly strict physics teacher in what is now year 9 and what we used to call third year, I think. And I hated her lessons. And I sneezed in one of her lessons. And while sneezing, I said, Jesus Christ. And she got so angry at me for swearing. She told me I was swearing. To be honest, at that point, I had no idea really that, I wasn't even really aware of the concept of blasphemy, I suppose. And I certainly didn't think anyone took such things seriously.
Right.
And I got into such trouble. She made me write out lines saying I must not swear in class. And it genuinely did not make sense to me that she thought I was swearing. But I later found out that she was a devout Christian or Catholic and that I had actually offended her very, very deeply. I shouldn't laugh.
And that put you off physics?
No, but it was just an example of how, like, my physics education was probably the same as lots of people's, which is, you know, you sit in a class totally unenthused and uninspired, and if you've got any kind of sense that you need to do well at school, you kind of learn the equations and you regurgitate the explanations. And I you know, at that point, you know, there was no sense for me that physics was a beautiful thing that could help me understand the natural world in a remarkable manner. You know, that's not what I thought of physics or and the other sciences. You know, this is a horrible thing to say, and apologies to my fellow science teachers, but, you know, like a lot of people, I thought biology was just labeling diagrams and memorizing them and coloring them in neatly so that you got a good mark from your teacher. I mean, that was my, you know, unfortunately, you know, my relationship with that particular school initially was figuring out how to get on and how to not get into trouble. And it took me at least the first year to realize that not getting into trouble was really easy. You just did what the teachers told you, and you underlined the title and you put the date on your work and you colored in within the lines. And, you know, it was quite a rather boring thing, but I knew that it was good for me, so I did it. Mm-hmm. And it was only later when, you know, I started to feel intellectually stimulated by science, really, at GCSE. And, you know, I absolutely credit the teachers I had later on for opening my eyes to what science is really about. And I think my early teachers kind of failed to do that. And I think, unfortunately, sadly, that is the experience that an awful lot of people had at school. And even more, unfortunately, today, we have a terrible shortage of science teachers, people who are properly qualified to teach about science. So I don't know what hope there is for today's children to be kind of enthused and inspired by their science lessons.
So you are enthused by science, inspired by science, and of course your books do create other enthusiastic advocates of science. I've given your book to children that I've known, and they have a great time with it. What's your next book, quick plug?
It's called Why Don't Things Fall Up, and 6 other lessons you missed at school. And as I said, it's a rather overambitious book, possibly. I've tried to condense into quite a slim volume all the key ideas that a good secondary school science education should cover, and I've tried to do it with very, very little maths and no diagrams.
That sounds perfect. So, but you're inspired by science, you're enthused by science. You said a moment ago that it, you know, physics was enabled you to appreciate the beauty of the universe and to make sense of it and so on. Is that its principal attraction for you? Understanding the way things are?
I think that I had a kind of intellectual awakening at some point in my later years at secondary school where I found learning about physics particularly and doing physics intellectually thrilling, which is a kind of really geeky thing to admit. But, you know, I think, how can I explain it? I think, you know, most people would relate to the idea of tasting something amazing and having their taste buds stimulated or whatever. A lot of people might enjoy the thrill that comes from playing sport or running and obviously there's sex, which I don't know if we're allowed to talk about, but
it's not against the law, Alan.
There are various ways in which we as physical beings experience enjoyment, and I think intellectual enjoyment often sounds like something pretentious, but for me, you know, books and reading had always provided intellectual stimulation and enjoyment. And then to stumble across physics and maths and the intellectual joy that one could get from those subjects, you know, that came late to me, but I'm really glad that I discovered them and that I was given the opportunity to experience that kind of thrill. And that's what I would want for everyone, you know, just in the same way that I would want for everyone to taste my lentils. I feel like, you know, everyone should have the opportunity to experience a kind of intellectual joy. And, you know, I think ideas are a bit like music and art. You know, there are some bits of music that you're so grateful to have heard. And I think we only get to hear music if we live in a culture and a community and a world which exposes us to lots of different types of music. You know, you can't possibly know whether or not you'd like the music of Prince if you never listen to it. And I think it's the same with ideas. You know, if you can't possibly know which ideas will resonate with you, which ideas will thrill you, unless you're exposed to them and exposed to them appropriately. So, you know, for me, you know, if you heard Prince being played by someone on the tube through some rubbish headphones and you were just catching something, if that was your only exposure to Prince, you would probably not fall in love with Prince. But, you know, if your first engagement with Prince was, you know, sitting with someone that you're in love with and they're like, I really want you to hear this great song, and they play it for you on some half decent speakers, you know, that's a completely different experience. And for me, talking about science is similar. I've just made this analogy up, by the way, on the spot, but
excellent.
You know, if you
it makes are, perfect sense
if you're I hope so if your only exposure to science is in a really boring science class when you're 12 and you've got all sorts of other things going on in your life and your teacher's this horrible strict monster of a person, then you're probably not going to fall in love with science.
Bright young people, schools as communities, the thrill of intellectual life and the duty of teaching. Thank you, Alam Shah, for telling us what you believe.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun to talk to you, Andrew.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.